The Thinking Behind It All with Melusine Knives.
The Thinking Behind It All.
Welcome to The Thinking Behind It All. This is our third edition, and as per usual, I've got my crew with me. I've got Isaac, I've got Ricardo, and I've got Pauline. Thank you for your feedback that we've had in the past couple of editions. This is our third one in a row, and keep the comments coming through on Facebook, The Thinking Behind It All. That's our page, The Thinking Behind It All. Or you can follow us on Twitter at TTBIA_. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
It's lovely to have you guys back here again. Seems like we have a jam-packed show. There are a number of issues that we're looking at. In this week's edition, we're looking at the Windrush situation in the UK. We're looking at Starbucks. We weren't going to pass up on that one. We are looking at President Cyril Ramaphosa's visit to the United Kingdom or the Commonwealth. And as we have been doing for the past two editions, we will also have a look at the latest Mamwini's situation, the latest developments there, what has arisen since Stratcom became the discussion point in the public space. Before we go into our stories, I would like us to discuss briefly racism. This is because there are mainly two issues that have come up for me in this week pertaining to racism. One being that of Judge Mutata, who has been found guilty of racism by the Judicial Tribunal in South Africa. And now this is going to lead to his impeachment, depending on what Parliament decides to do. What had happened in this particular case pertaining to the judge is that back in 2007, he was driving under the influence. He crashed into a wall, and inevitably what happened is the owner of the house in this affluent suburban area in Johannesburg, a white man, was quite displeased with what happened, and the officials were called in. In his stupor, the judge then said a number of things. One of the things that he said is that no Boer. Now, Boer is a term used in South Africa to refer to white people, and actually it's Afrikaners. They also refer to themselves as the Boeres. So anyway, he made a statement saying that no Boer is going to tell me what to do in my land or our land. Something along those lines. Of course, I'm paraphrasing. And these comments were attributed to him being found guilty of racism, ultimately. A civil society organization representing Afrikaner people found his comments to be racist. That's how they interpreted it. And they then took it up with the Judicial Tribunal, saying that his use of the word Boer, alongside everything else that he said, was racist. It has now led to a situation where he finds himself in, where he's being forced to be held accountable for what he said. And the other situation in which I would like us to discuss racism, a very well-known radio presenter in a local talk radio station in Johannesburg talked about this month's special on National Geographic, where they are leading with the story of twins. One is black and one is white.
Have a look at this month's National Geographic magazine. I think it's so instructive. They've got a special feature on race. Black and white, they're calling it. And the cover story has a pair of twins, two 11-year-old girls whose parents are a mixed race couple. The father is black and the mother is white. And the girls are very much like their parents in that regard. The one presents black and the other presents white. But they're twins. See, genetically, like any siblings, never mind twins, as we now know, one can easily resemble the mother and the other sibling the father. This is no miracle, but I mean, it's biology. But because we see people generally through the lens of race, an artificially constructed concept, we marvel. And this is why I think Toni Morrison argues that racism is a distraction, because it keeps you from doing what you're supposed to do. It keeps you from doing your work, as she says. So I, as a black man, for example, if I want to call out anti-white racism, I've got to preface everything I say by proving my black credentials. I've got to say, you know, I'm as black as the next guy. I too have been a victim of anti-black racism. I've got to qualify something that actually, on the face of it, is wrong. Anti-white racism is wrong.
In contemporary society, do we accept that black people can be called racist, considering that the term is no more than 100 years old and is mostly defined in Eurocentric dictionaries and books? Ricardo, what are your thoughts?
Can black people be racist? I think in specific circumstances, it's possible. The possibility is there. But just the way the world is currently constituted, it is extremely hard or difficult, in my opinion, for a black person to be truly racist.
Ice, what are your thoughts, man?
So when I think of racism, I'm thinking more of a systemic issue. I don't necessarily think that one person in a country fairly new to democracy could be racist. When I think of racism, it's more of a broader issue about systems of racism through the law and how a country is governed.
Pauline, what do you have to say?
I think there can be, but not at a level that they intentionally mean to use it to make a difference.
Please clarify.
I think they're racist, like to talk and be more freely racist among their friends and family, but in an ignorant way. But then when it comes to things in the bigger picture, they don't portray that racism. They don't show that racism.
Isaac, what do you have to say about what Pauline just said to us?
With regards to what Pauline said, I think I was focusing more on a historical context of South Africa, in that black people haven't been empowered economically or systemically to make decisions that affect another race. Sure, they may be tribalism amongst black people here in South Africa, but I don't think that is the same as racism as we are discussing it here on the podcast.
Ricardo, when you think about racism, how do you define it? What are the key elements?
When we talk about racism, I think of two aspects, the cultural and the institutionalized or the governmental aspects of racism, you know, where laws and regulations are skewed to favor one specific race over another.
This is to Pauline. So if we can accept that black people can be prejudicial, they can be hateful, how can we then want to attribute racism to them, especially if we accept the premise that they do not have economic power?
when they make certain comments and want to engage with a country where the population is totally black and where they do govern, because there are parts of Africa that are governed by black African people, but you'll find that they do have a form of racism against those that are in power over them.
If we accept that racism is, according to the Eurocentric dictionary, one person thinking or behaving in a way as though he or she is superior to another person, surely we need to think about the theoretical definition of racism too. What are your thoughts, Ricardo?
No. And I'm just saying that because I want to be contrarian. There definitely is a theoretical aspect, but here's the thing. So we talk about economic power and political power, right? Let's take this high court judge that you mentioned, right? Did he not possess the power to give a lot of people a really bad time?
He's subjected to other rules and regulations.
Aren't white judges in South Africa subject to the same rules and regulations, and we see those rules and regulations circumvented all the time to put other people down?
The answer to that is that they are. But who made those rules and regulations? Who made those institutions? Who conceptualized them?
It doesn't matter how many rules and regulations you have. When you are a judge, at least in every system I've ever seen, there are certain latitude you're given to make decisions, right? So if it's just giving a person, let's say if it's a criminal court, giving sentencing, right? Giving someone 6 months compared to a year, right? And what if you say, okay, well, I have the ability to give this person a year in jail or no jail time at all. Can you be questioned? It's within your purview to do so.
Isaac, don't you think there'll be consequences for such a judge or black people who think of themselves as people who are in power?
Yes, definitely. There'd be consequences given how our judiciary is organized here in South Africa. In fact, how I see our judiciary being organized, it's like a white boys club. There is a standard here in South Africa in terms of being a judge, and it's a white standard. That's why we have black lawyers and black judges wanting to emulate white behavior or how judges go about considering cases here in South Africa. Also, one would have to consider what he said. The word Boer isn't seen as racist when it's used by Boers. I mean,
See, that confused me too, because, okay, so I'm an outsider, I'm an American, but I love history, and I'm like, I read about the Boer War, and I've never heard Afrikaners, you know, jump up and arms. Don't call it that.
In fact, they take pride in that word, in that it gives them their masculinity.
Pauline, in closing, do you think racism is an obstacle that black people use?
No, I don't think they use it.
Ricardo, your thoughts?
This is one of the things that I get annoyed about. So there are black people who use racism as an excuse for what's wrong in their lives. But this is such a small minority of people that I don't even think it should be brought up.
Isaac, do we use racism as an obstacle?
What, us as black people?
Are you white?
Oh, that's smart though. Someone had a bad day at work. Dang.
Do we use it as an obstacle? No, I don't think we use it as an obstacle. We use it rather for redress. I mean, we've been in this Eurocentric system for so long that we feel we need to balance the scales.
Well, fellow listeners, please let us know what your thoughts are with regards to this debate. Go to our Facebook page, The Thinking Behind It All. Like the page, let us know what you think of what we've just said, or you can do so on Twitter at TTBIA_.
Well, President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced Trevor Manuel, Mkabisi Jonas, Yaku Maria and Phumzile Langeni as the country's investment envoys. This ahead of the investment conference due to be held in August or September. During his inauguration, the president emphasized his plan to revive the country's economy through direct foreign investment. The president made the announcement at the O.R. Tambo International Airport ahead of his departure to the United Kingdom, where he'll attend the Commonwealth Heads of Government Summit. A South African delegation will be in the UK to engage potential investors on the sidelines of the summit. Through the so-called investment lions, the aim is to attract $100 billion over the next 5 years.
An investment in our economy has declined, as we all know, in recent years, and Treasury tells us that total fixed investment in the economy stood at 24% of GDP in 2008. It has declined to lower levels of up to 19% of GDP up to last year. Now, when we drafted the National Development Plan under my neighbor sitting here, Trevor Manuel, we said that we need to increase investment, fixed investment in our economy to up to 30% of GDP by 2030. Now, this needs to be a determined journey that we need to take, and this has been the lack of investment has also been accompanied by low business confidence, poor growth in employment, and economic conditions in the country keep on changing. And we are now determined to work with all social partners to seize the opportunities that we see opening up.
The Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting is a meeting where 53 members of the Commonwealth meet, 19 from Africa, 13 from the Caribbean, and 3 from Europe. And what they do here is they decide on a program of action for the next 2 years for all these members that are part of the Commonwealth. Our new head of state, Cyril, goes to this meeting with the intention of wooing investors and ensuring the Commonwealth that South Africa is still a good place to invest in. In fact, he says that he wants to write a book of investment for South Africa. At the beginning of the week, he announces his dream team that's going to help him in this endeavor. First is Trevor Manuel, the former finance minister. He's basically the right-hand man to help Cyril convince investors that we're still a good place to invest in. There's Mkabisi Jonas, who was influential in Save SA, and his role here is to prove that SA is not a corrupt nation as it was portrayed by the Zuma administrations. Two interesting people he includes are two females, Phumzile Langeni from the AfroPulse group. She's taken because of her private sector knowledge. And Trudy Makaya is the new economic advisor. Last member of the team is Yako Marie, former CEO of Standard Bank and currently the chair of Liberty Holdings.
Not forgetting that APSA's CEO is also there, right?
Yeah, she's there as well, yes.
Trevor Manuel's girlfriend or wife.
News reports in the UK reported Cyril Ramaphosa as aiming for 3% GDP growth by the end of 2018. He's also planned for well-crafted incentives in tax and industry to give investors good security and to prove that we are still very reliable in terms of investing. He was also asked about the question of land. He did say that this was an important historical issue that needed to be addressed and that we were going to protect the property rights of all citizens using the parameters of the Constitution.
Pauline, my question to you, since you are from the UK, do you guys have any money to give us?
You know what? I think that going to the Commonwealth gathering, it's going to be beneficial to both England and South Africa, because, you know, we're going through Brexit, and, you know, whatever business contracts we can accumulate, you know, especially for the next coming 3-4 years and beyond. I think this is a good thing. You've got a new president. Give him time.
Isaac, it seems like we are Britain's get-out-of-jail-free card. What do you think of that?
Well, you could say that, man, considering the IMF increased our investment growth from 1.3 to 1.5 this week. And speaking of money, Theresa May just gave Ramaphosa at the end of the meeting 50 million pounds. That translates to about 800 million rands. This will, of course, span over the next 4 years, and it's going to help SA business become more attractive to the international community and dismantle these barriers for intercontinental trade within Africa. Well, that's what they say.
Ricardo, what do you make of the fact that you still have countries like South Africa who are more than willing to return to the colonial masters to go beg for money?
I am so glad you asked me this, because as Isaac was talking about the goings-on, I was just like, Commonwealth in 2018? Why is this even happening? Like, what exactly is a Commonwealth? Like, you know, in the current geopolitical climate, you know, we find ourselves. I'm not really sure what it means anymore. If you submit or subject yourself to being a Commonwealth, right? So to me, that feels like, so if England entangles themselves in some Middle Eastern war, what? They're going to get South African men and women to go fight for them? Like, so, or is it this strictly an economic arrangement? And, you know what I mean?
Well, I think it's, what are the boundaries here? I think it's more economical, because obviously we've seen what's gone on in Syria the past, you know, the past few weeks, the past week or so. You know, 150 other countries could have said, yeah, we'll join England and France. So I think it's more to do with economics.
Isaac, what are your thoughts about countries like ours who still subject themselves to slavery? We talk of us being independent and having freed ourselves from the shackles of oppression, yet we are quick to run to the colonial masters.
It's actually quite sad. We think of ourselves as sovereign states here and as independent, especially here in Africa, but meetings like these, they actually prove that we actually aren't. I mean, at a point where people died in this country for our liberation, but for us in democracy to find out that we aren't really as free as we thought, it's a shame. It's a damn shame.
Pauline, my question to you is, do you think that black nations, or at least black countries, should they still be so reliant or subject themselves to the rule of their former colonial masters?
I think they need to learn to take chances with others, because I think it's a thing, you go to who you know, you what you're familiar with, you stick with. And I think they need to take chances with, you know, like the Chinese. I know that the Chinese are doing good things in South Africa at the moment, but I just think they need to basically put their toe in the water a little bit more and be more receptive to other nations other than just Europe.
Ricardo, when African leaders look towards the East, all of a sudden they are characterized as being corrupt, there are issues of governance, and they are accused of maladministration. What do you make of that?
This is an old Cold War mentality. For the most part, when we speak about doing business with the East, we're talking about China, Russia, Vietnam, right? We're talking about dictatorships or communist regimes, generally speaking, or absolute monarchies, things of that nature. And the Cold War mentality still lives on in the West. We believe that we will give these black people or these Africans the better deal, you know. And it's, history has shown that that's not necessarily true.
2018 marks 70 years since HMT Empire Windrush docked in the Essex town of Tilbury, carrying 492 Caribbean passengers. Encouraged by a newspaper advertisement offering cheap transport, hundreds of Jamaicans made the trip to the country they had fought for in the Second World War in the hope of finding work. The UK faced a labour shortage following the devastation wrought by the war, and the passing of the British Nationality Act in 1948 gave Caribbean and other Commonwealth peoples British citizenship and full rights of entry and settlement. The images of West Indians disembarking the Windrush have come to symbolise the beginning of British multiculturalism, with those who arrived in the UK in the late 1940s often referred to as the Windrush generation. This wave of newcomers faced social and economic exclusion upon arrival, and were regularly denied private employment and accommodation on the basis of race. Over the following years, the Caribbean community often faced racial prejudice and violence, and during the 1960s and 1970s, the government passed new legislation to impose stricter immigration controls. The 1971 Immigration Act restricted primary immigration to the UK, but allowed Commonwealth citizens already in the country indefinite leave to remain. However, the Home Office did not issue paperwork confirming the status of those who arrived before 1971, leaving a number of the Windrush generation in 2018 facing the prospect of deportation from the country they have called home for decades.
What's been highlighted in the news this week is how when Theresa May was working in the Home Office, she was doing a scourge on immigrants. These people seem to have fell through the net, because the department had got in touch with certain people from the Caribbean and basically said if they can't prove who they are and when they came to England, that basically they'd have to be deported. And a lot of these people were children when they came over, so they came with their parents or they came on their parents' passports and so on. And a lot of people who have been caught up in this, they've lost the right to have a driving license, healthcare, work, social housing. They've lost everything. And some people have worked here for many years, you know, in the health service, working for like local government and so on.
Ricardo, what do you make of all of this? I mean, we have England, a country or a people that have a history of going around the world, plundering and massacring nations. And this is not me being dramatic, if there's someone who thinks so. Now, all of a sudden, they are faced by this dilemma where they have to contemplate the lives of people who they essentially invited into their homeland.
I find this truly to be a shame. As a person who is of Jamaican descent, I know many people who have gone to England and who parents are of the Windrush generation, or grandparents in some instances. Let's just bring it back to when this happened. So it was right after World War II. England is in a shambles. Basically, all of Europe is in a shambles, right? They need warm bodies. Millions of their own have just died in a war, right? So they say, okay, let's bring these people along to do work that basically we don't have the manpower, the labor to get done. And these are usually your menial jobs, your miners, your bus drivers, things of that nature.
Nurses.
Nurses, right? Why not take care of these people? I mean, they helped you out. I think they owe it to these people. I truly do. So they owe it to these people who gave their lives to help them rebuild.
Isaac, do you think it's right for it to be a point of contention in England to debate about black lives that they either want or don't want, considering what Ricardo just mentioned here?
I mean, of course not, man. It's quite savage, Joe, that they'd even do something like this. And what's worse is that these people have actually integrated into the English society. They are productive members of that society. And for them to be, like, shunned away now as if they came to the country illegally, it's sad, man.
Pauline, why is there an avoidance of talking about
this matter being also about racism by the media. Is this how English media usually operates, or is this just not to raise tempers in society? What's this about?
Obviously, the timing it's been brought out, and you know, with this old Brexit thing where it's surrounded by we're being told that immigrants, the old immigrant story, you know, history tends to repeat itself, and the media tends to magnify it to the point that, you know, no English person will get a job because some immigrant's going to come in and take it.
Ricardo, I need to ask you, the fact that people are not really talking about this outside the UK, is there something to be said about that?
When we talk about Afro-Caribbean countries, islands and nations, issues like this always take a backseat on a global scale. I think about on the island of España, you know, where there's Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and how they were just rounding up people with dark skin and deporting them to Haiti, not even caring if they were Haitian.
So, Isaac, white supremacy has succeeded in its agenda of dividing and conquering.
So I think most of the arrogance that comes from these Western countries is the fact that they bank on dependency from the people that they enslave.
But my question to you is, do you think, considering that there is silence from other quarters, other black people in the world, do you think white supremacy has succeeded in that regard in dividing and conquering us?
Yes, because they place different classes amongst ourselves. The only people that they're talking to are probably black leaders, our black elected politicians, when they go to places like Commonwealth meetings. And over there, it's people that have bought into the idea of being a part of the establishment.
Just to piggyback on what Isaac said, I don't even think it's specifically an issue of divide and conquer when it comes to race. It's more about nationalism and jingoism. So,
but nationalism is a form of divide and conquer.
Right, but I was just saying, I don't think it's racially specific in this case, because put it like this, if you live in England and you're a second or third generation Russian, you're probably just as eager to kick out Eastern Europeans from England than anybody else.
The CEO of Starbucks is in Philadelphia tonight performing damage control. The coffee chain is facing protests and boycott threats after two black men were arrested for not making a purchase and refusing to leave the store. Michelle Miller reports from Philadelphia.
What do we want?
Activists upset over Thursday's incident protested inside the coffee chain this morning and outside this afternoon, calling it a clear case of racial profiling. Shared millions of times on social media, the video shows two black men handcuffed and arrested for sitting at a Starbucks without buying anything. They claim they were there for a business meeting and were waiting for someone.
Starbucks says the employee who initially complained to police is no longer at that store.
CEO Kevin Johnson apologized and traveled to Philadelphia, where he plans to meet the two men.
What happened in the way that incident escalated? And the outcome was nothing but reprehensible. And I'm sorry.
If they were white, would this have happened?
None of the white customers were asked to leave, and they were there a lot longer than those young men.
Stuart Cohen represents the two men.
Even if the charges get expunged or relieved, it does follow you for the rest of your life.
That Helen Gim is a Philadelphia city councilwoman.
Starbucks is an example and an indicator of what's happening all across the city of Philadelphia and across the country, frankly.
Okay, you may be a store mayor, but you're not there. You're not.
Today, a video surfaced on Twitter that was shot in January, showing police in Los Angeles confronting a black man who was denied access to a Starbucks bathroom after a white man was given the code. Neither had bought anything from the chain.
What did I do? I just tried to use a bathroom like you did, and they gave it to you.
And before they come forward to speak, the yet-to-be-identified men that were arrested here said to their attorney they want to see real change in the way Starbucks handles people like them. In the meantime, Jeff, we should note that Police Commissioner Richard Ross continues to stand behind the actions of his officers.
It's really become quite a firestorm here in the United States, so much so that the CEO of Starbucks got involved, and he implemented a racial sensitivity training day, essentially, on May 29th, where 8,000 Starbucks across the country will be closed, affecting tens of thousands of employees. You know, it's raising a lot of issues over the subtle kind of racism that you often see, the racism that you could never really prove. Just the letter of the law, Starbucks is a privately held company, right? It's not a public space. If they ask you to leave, they have the right to do so if you don't buy anything. But that being said, that's their written policy. But the truth of it is, they try to foster an atmosphere of conviviality. Everybody come in, have fun, sit down and work, catch up with your friends, and we, for the most part, will leave you alone. But there's a certain disparity in the treatment of this when it comes to people of color. We've just found out yesterday that the manager of this Starbucks has been fired as well.
Colleen, do you think it's something to be said about these quote-unquote sensitivity trainings in addressing covert racism?
I'm all for them because not everyone has the same experience. And when you go and work for a company as big as Starbucks, it's imperative that the staff has that training. And then you're all basically singing off the same page.
So as a form of socialization, are you also in agreement with what Pauline's saying with regards to sensitivity training?
No. This thing of training your people to be like robots and just take
It's to be robots. I think it's just because, as I said, Isaac, people have different experiences and people are not always aware of their biasnesses. If you're going to come and work for the company and to ensure that everyone has had the right training, then you know we're all singing off the same sheet.
Ricardo?
I am for the sensitivity training. I do understand Isaac's point, though. I see where he's coming from, and I think there is an argument to be made and to be had.
He likes being on the fence.
I don't think he's necessarily on the fence. No, I'm not being on the fence. But here's why I think the sensitivity training should happen. It's mainly what Pauline said. They have a diverse clientele, right? And people sometimes cannot escape their prejudice and bias that they grew up with. But if, as a company, if you could say, this is how specifically we want you to treat individuals, it takes a lot of the ambiguity out of it. And I also think they need to align their written policies with their front-facing rules of thumb, so to say. You can't have it both ways. That's why I don't believe this woman should have been fired. If she could do everything by the book and still
you talk about
get
the
in
manager.
Trouble. Yeah, the manager of the Starbucks. Because she did everything by the book, by the letter of the law, she was in the right, right? But she still ends up with a job. Why? Because Starbucks has very ambiguous ways of doing things.
Isaac, what do you make of the fact that the manager is being fired? Considering what we talked about, racism, at the beginning of the show, that, you know, you're subject to rules and regulations. There she was thinking that she's doing the right thing in accordance with what the institution, if we can call it that, would have wanted to be done, because that's the culture. But now, because of PR, she's being fired.
It's the hypocrisy of what liberal democracies, I guess. To protect ourselves, other people will feel the brunt. When you look at her situation specifically, should she have been fired for upholding company rules when they train you to do that? It seems a bit unfair.
Pauline, what are your thoughts?
I have to agree with Isaac. I totally agree with Isaac. There's no way that lady should have been fired. She was made a scapegoat for them.
The remnants of Winnie Mandela this week, it starts at the funeral. The leadership of the ANC gave the mother of the nation a state's funeral. And what particularly piqued my interest in the funeral was the speech given by Julius Malema. Julius Malema, he goes on this rant of the speech where he's like, he's going in on everyone who is there.
Mama, some of those who sold out to the regime are here. And what is funny, Mama, is that they are crying the loudest, more than all of us who cared for you. Mama, the UDF cabal is here. The cabal that rejected you and disowned you and sent you to the brutal apartheid regime is here. We see you in your beautiful suits, betrayals, sellouts. We see you.
It trended so much that there was an official Malema challenge, you know. Everyone on Twitter just got on some, yeah, we see our crushes, they're out here, they also don't like our posts and things like that. Because of that speech, his speech, I'd say, was the most nuanced of all the speeches that were given over there. Sydney Mufamadi, former Minister of Safety and Security, comes under fire, and he has a presser, in fact, this week, the most pathetic presser I've ever seen.
I must tell you, sitting in that position, there are many, many teams that were formed to investigate various things. I left government 11 years ago, right, 10 years ago. So if you woke me up at night and said, do you remember this? I wouldn't immediately remember. Even Heslinger, assuming he was genuine, in your documentary, he says 1994. Yeah, so I say he's talking about Father Merve's time. No, I'm saying. And he said, no, later he said, I made a mistake.
No, he didn't make a mistake. I removed something in the editing because in 1994 he explained that he became head of the murder squad in Victoria.
No, but I'm saying he said he was called to my office to be instructed to investigate in 1994. So I'm saying if his memory would need to be assisted, that applies to everybody else's memory. Now, I'm saying this to make the point that I saw also that Fivers was mixing up things in the interview.
He gives all these weird reasons like, oh, this is just a ploy by the Afrikaners to destabilize our movement because they're seeing that we're going to be united because of Mama Winnie's funeral. But this is the same man who didn't even come to Mama Winnie's funeral. He was essential in reopening all the cases about the killing of Stompie Bey.
Ricardo, what do we make of instances like these? I mean, we've discussed this in previous podcasts, and I'm not saying we need to rehash that, but all of a sudden, there's no person that persecuted Mama Winnie. And one of the most instrumental people, a political figure, at a time when the country was in transition, a new government is being established, heading, quote-unquote, the police force, he says he had nothing to do with the reopening of the case. Does that sound right to you?
It's absurd. And let me tell you, I've never heard a person switch to cover your ass mode like this guy did. It was like, oh, well, you know, At that time, the things were different. The whole story isn't out. I didn't want to speak on it. I didn't want to overshadow her passing. All this other stuff. And listen, you know what song kept playing in my mind? You know the Shaggy song, It Wasn't Me? That was like, I was sitting there like... Man, best he just said nothing. He should have just kept his mouth shut. Honestly, sometimes it's just easier to say nothing.
What do you think, Pauline? Is this the trade-off that we have to deal with when it comes to democracies?
All that they're coming out with, it's like, oh, my ass is on fire. I got to run and chat it all. And I'm so sorry. It's a load of poppycock. Who are they appealing to? Come on, who is this person's audience who thinks that, you know, what he's saying is justified?
You heard him say that black people need to be aware, and of course, I'm not quoting him verbatim, but he's trying to depict this as a situation where people are being divided and they're being exploited in some kind of way, that they need to be cautious, you know, the tactics of apartheid, as if we are ignorant to this. I mean, his government or his department at least we use this kind of method in any way.
This man know what he know all along. Why did he wait and for her passing to want to come out with all this tirade now? Black people are not that stupid. Do not insult our intelligence because you want to sit down and rant about your butt hurt heart feelings right now.
He's a freaking worm, Pauline. That's all. He's a worm. He's a worm. Let me tell you, he knew exactly what was going on at
going
the time.
On.
He probably even co-signed some of it. He was benefiting from her character assassination.
Ricardo, just what do you make of him playing victim? I mean, he's saying that I was also called to the TRC.
Oh,
I also had to account.
That's the part that bothers me the most, to be honest. Because I think I would make a terrible politician because I like to own my shit. Because I would have more respect for him if he said, look, these are the decisions I made 25 years ago. I believed I was doing them in good faith. History has proved me wrong. I apologize. And move on.
Ice, why was Julius Malema on his soapbox in the funeral?
Given his relationship with Mama Winnie and him being a former member of the ANC, I think he felt as if he owed her to call out all the people that were there and tell them that they sold her out.
Do we accept that political grandstanding is okay, Ricardo, when it comes to situations like this? I mean, low-hanging fruit, so you were supposed to pick them.
You're speaking about Julius specifically. Political grandstanding? I'm of two minds because it might have been political grandstanding, but it was true. So it's like he took up the political football, yes. He has made political capital by saying it. But I don't think anyone can really dispute or refute his claims with any veracity, you know? Those people know who they are. They know what they did, you know? I'm okay with the way he leveraged this.
This brings us to the end of this week's show. Thank you for listening. Please remember to drop us a comment. Tell us how much you love us. Of course, we need that. It's an ego boost. Tell us where we can improve. You can do this on Facebook, The Thinking Behind It All. That's our page. Or you can tweet us at @TTBIA_. I'd like to thank my team. This was a great show. I enjoyed working with you. Thank you to Isaac. Thank you to Pauline. And thank you to my boy Mahambane. Until we meet next week. Shalom.